Rebonjour à tous et toutes et bienvenue à celles et ceux qui nous rejoignent pour cette dernière session qui va poser la question de l'impact de la féminisation que nous traitons depuis hier. Est-ce que la présence de magistrates fait une différence? Alors, peut-être parce que je suis un homme, mais je suis moins créatif que mes collègues Joanne Poirier ou Anne Lagerwal, donc je n'ai pas prévu de petites caricatures ou encore moins d'extraits de films pour introduire cette session. Mais la transition est parfaite. Je vous suggère, si ça vous intéresse, de consulter le numéro 21 de 2009 du Canadian Journal of Women and the Law, qui était exclusivement consacré à la représentation de la femme dans le cinéma et qui a été édité par l'une de nos intervenantes de cet après-midi, donc Rebecca Johnson, que je remercie d'être ici parmi nous, qui nous vient de Colombie-Britannique, de l'Université de Victoria, et qui enseigne différentes matières, mais qui s'est spécialisée dans la recherche sur les questions de genre, mais également sur l'analyse de la production de la justice, recherche dont elle nous présentera un aspect avec sa collègue Marie-Claire Bellot, qui nous vient de l'Université Laval à Québec. Alors Marie-Claire Bellot, je la remercie également d'être parmi nous. Elle a nombreuses cordes à son arc académique et scientifique. Tout à l'heure, Jacques Comaille évoquait les mécanismes de médiation. Bien, Marie-Claire s'intéresse à ces processus dits alternatifs de règlement des différends. Elle s'intéresse évidemment aux questions de genre et Marie-Claire Bellot a une expérience pratique de praticienne assez importante, que ce soit au barreau du Québec, mais également auprès de toute une série de ministères et d'organisations publiques pour lesquelles elle a travaillé. Alors, Rebecca Johnson et Marie-Claire Bellot, je profite de l'occasion pour les remercier aussi pour leur contribution, non pas seulement au progrès de la connaissance sur la question, mais aussi pour leur contribution à l'organisation et à la supervision scientifique de ce colloque. Elle faisait en effet partie du comité d'organisation de ce colloque piloté par Adélaïde Remiche. Alors elles nous entretiendront de l'impact de ces femmes, ou en tout cas de ce que leur présence peut produire, à travers l'analyse d'un indicateur particulièrement intéressant et presque exotique pour les juristes habitués à la tradition civiliste, à savoir les opinions dissidentes. On aura le plaisir également d'entendre, avant cette intervention, Laura Ely, qui nous vient de l'Université d'Oxford. Merci aussi, Laura, thanks for being here among us. Laura Ely, elle est spécialisée dans l'étude des droits humains. D'ailleurs, je vous suggère de visiter le blog qu'elle coordonne, le Oxford Human Rights Hub blog. Et Laura Ely nous présentera une sorte de sociologie compréhensive de la façon dont les juges problématisent la question du genre, puisqu'elle a interviewé plusieurs magistrates et magistrats de pays de common law. Et cette sociologie compréhensive, elle sera aussi au cœur de la contribution de Caroline Simon, qui est également procédé à des entretiens de magistrats et de magistrates, mais belges. Caroline Simon, elle est doctorante ici au Centre d'Histoire et d'Anthropologie du Droit de l'Université Libre de Bruxelles, et je la remercie également de participer à cette session. Et enfin, et je pense que le contraste méthodologique sera fécond, nous aurons également le plaisir, après la pause, d'entendre Thomas Léonard, qui nous vient de l'Université de Lille, et plus particulièrement du Centre d'Études et de Recherches Administratives, Politiques et Sociales, le CERAP, puisqu'en effet, lui, il a une perspective plus quantitative. Il nous présentera en effet l'analyse qu'il a produite à partir du dépouillement de centaines et de centaines de décisions adoptées par un tribunal de comparution immédiate en France. Voilà, sans plus attendre, Laura Ely, je vous cède immédiatement la parole. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you. I'd also like to add my great gratitude to the organisers of this conference, particularly my good friend Adelaide Remiche, It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be here presenting on a topic that I've spent the last 3 years of my life researching as part of my doctoral thesis. And it's nice to have a good friend like Adelaide who has decided to organise this conference, I believe, just for me and to help my research. So today what I'm going to do is draw upon new empirical data that I've collected between 2012 and 2013. So in this period, I interviewed 30 judges from superior appellate courts in South Africa, Australia, and the United Kingdom. The purpose of these interviews was to investigate whether senior appellate court judges perceive that their own life experiences, their gendered experiences in particular, would impact upon the collegial decision-making process and also upon their own decision-making process. So here is my central question of inquiry. So in this paper, I'm going to do three things. First, I'm going to set out a theoretical basis from which my research is drawn upon. Many of you will be familiar with what is called standpoint theory. I'm using it particularly as it has been developed by Patricia Hill Collins and her concept of the outsider within. Second, I'm going to say a few brief words about some of the methodological choices that I made in conducting my research. This panel today is a nice example of different methodological approaches to understanding what impact gender might or might not have on decision making. And finally, I'm going to look at two of the discrete outcomes that have come from my research. This is only a snapshot of the material that I have gathered, however, for the benefit of time and trying to stay on time, I can only talk about two. And I'm going to do this by reference to two assumptions that are held in the common law world. The first is that the judge is a non-subjective actor, or judging is a neutral activity. We spoke about this a little bit this morning and interrogated whether or not that was true or was not true. The second assumption that I'm going to look at in my material is whether the identity of the decision maker matters or not. So whether it matters whether the judge is a woman or a man or has some other identity association. So first, just a quick overview of standpoint theory. Feminist standpoint theory is derived from traditional Marxist theory, and it focuses upon the epistemological value of perspectives that have been shaped by life experiences. I think that standpoint theory is particularly useful for interrogating the impact that gender has on judicial decision making. First, it highlights the epistemological value of perspectives that have been enriched by gender experience. It doesn't place firm categorical boundaries around what a woman's experience is. Rather, it is capable of encompassing many ways in which we experience gender and which women experience gender. It has the ability to encompass the shared experience without doing away with what is unique about our own experiences. Second, this concept relies on an idea of the outsider within. And this highlights a valuable didactic relationship between new experiential knowledges and a traditional or received body of knowledge. So as the two interact, we may be able to have new perspectives. Finally, this theory says that these new perspectives will enrich a body of jurisprudence that has been limited in the number of experiences that have previously impacted upon the received or traditional knowledges. So in a similar way to what we do as comparative lawyers, standpoint theory gives a lens through which we can focus on what has been termed the strange in the familiar. We can critically challenge received knowledge. We might be able to correct misassumptions or stereotypes that have arisen from an over-reliance upon inferential knowledge. And we can also facilitate greater levels of impartiality. Now, one point that's very important to stress is that in Hill Collins's thesis, for a self-defined standpoint to exist, experience itself alone is not enough. Rather, it's the interconnectedness between this experience, thought, and self-reflection of your experience that allows a specific standpoint to develop and to have the real value. So it's not enough just for a woman to have lived a woman's life. They must have been self-reflective about this experience and how it might be shared or might not be shared with those that are also sitting around the decision-making table. So, which methodology? I think that methodology sometimes can be viewed as a really dry and boring area in sort of academic work, but I think in this area it's really important. I think there are a lot of assumptions that underlie our methodological choices and that necessarily then impact upon the results that we come up with. So, to date, I think that there have been four main broad categories of methodology chosen to being pursued in this area. The first is a quantitative outcomes-based research. So this is counting votes, counting how often a woman will find for an applicant, how often she'll find for the defendant, where her votes may lie in dissent or in the majority. A second form is doctrinal analysis. So this is work where we look for voices coming out of the texts of decisions and deciding whether when we have new actors participating in these decisions, there might necessarily be new or unique voices arising. A third way is alternative judgment writing, and I won't say too much about this because Erica will, in the panel decision after, speak about how alternative judgment writing may help us interrogate the question of what contribution gender might or might not have to decision making. But the final approach is qualitative interview-based research. And I'm delighted to have Carolyn also on the panel, and she's adopted this methodology for her research. I feel that this is an underutilized methodology in this area. There are some pragmatic reasons for that, but I think that it is a powerful one and one that we should investigate how to use more of. I think that interviews or a narrative method allows for the complexities that have come up already in our discussions to be explored at greater depth. It allows intersections of gender experiences with other life experiences to come to the fore. It provides a fuller picture of why it matters that courts have an equal number of men and women judges. And so what you're doing with qualitative interview-based research is that the judges and the ones that are actually doing the judgment are given a voice to speak, not only about the decision, but about what they feel they're doing in the process. Of course, this too can be a very problematic methodology. We're asking judges to give their perception on something that they may do consciously or even subconsciously. Judges are only offering their perception, and this may be a very different thing from a steadfast scientific fact. Judges may labour under a false sense of consciousness. They may be eager to please the young and naive interviewee sitting before them by providing a perfect feminist, or what they think is a perfect feminist reasoned response to her questions. They can also perhaps look back on events with rose-coloured glasses, and what they would have hoped to do or what they would have hoped had influenced their decision, in fact, at the time of making that decision, might not actually have been the case. It also relies upon judges interrogating their own experience to an extent that, in a busy court, most judges just wouldn't do. One of my interviewees said to me, when I asked him about what went through his mind when he was deciding cases, he said, "Well, I just do it." So despite all of these limitations, I do believe that there's been a growing awareness in the literature of the benefit of this type of research, and I hope that I can add a small contribution to it today in this talk. So my research design, just quickly, it was semi-structured interviews with men and women, judges from the three superior appellate courts in the jurisdictions, that I was looking at, so South Africa, the United Kingdom, and Australia. What I tried to do when I was getting my interview pool together was to have an even number of women and men from each jurisdiction. Now, looking at superior appellate courts in these jurisdictions, that's no easy feat. So what I would also do is look for judges who had, in their biographical information that was available online, identified themselves as associating with another kind of outsider or other. For example, through sexual orientation, perhaps through national origin, socioeconomic background, or racial or ethnic origin. I mean, unsurprisingly, this too didn't provide for a very large pool of participants. However, when I ran out of different judges, I went back to the usual suspects, and they provided some very insightful comments on how the otherness of their colleagues may have or may have not, in their opinion, impacted upon their decision making. I was very careful in South Africa to approach men and women from different racial groups. In Australia, the same initiative could not be undertaken because of the racial homogeneity of the superior appellate courts as in the United Kingdom. So moving on from, so that's how I did it, what I did, but now I want to talk about what I found, or as I like to say, the juicy bits. Who told me what? Who said what about whom? So what I'm going to do is structure this around two assumptions. These have been contested in academic literature, but they go towards, I guess, a very traditional understanding of common law judging and the role of the judge. So the first assumption is that judging is a non-subjective exercise. Judges just apply the law. The second one is that a judge's identity does not matter. His or her gender will not impact upon the way that they decide a case. So, on to the first one. Assumption one, judges just apply the law. So by now, I hope it is uncontroversial in common law jurisdictions to say that judging is more than just a mechanical process. This is because both law is unavoidably and necessarily what one has described as open textured. It's unavoidably open textured because there is a limit inherent in the nature of language to the guidance which general language can provide. And it's also necessary because of the human fallibility of the legislature to anticipate every event that might come before a court and prescribe the exact outcome that a judge must take in any particular factual scenario. So for the common law, the common law method in particular also intensifies this imprecision through the application of the doctrine of precedent, where judges are needing to make decisions and choices about whether a case is of the same kind of what has come before or whether it is different. So this choice also comes in a number of other forms in common law judging. The judge has to draw inferences, interpret statutes, apply or distinguish precedents, give weight to certain facts and issues, and disregard others. And all of these activities involve choice, or, obviously, judgment on the part of a judge. All of the judges that I interviewed accepted, to varying degrees, the truth in this statement, that judging does involve some objective assessment. I explored this question with my participants by asking them how they thought that common sense or social awareness impacted upon the work that they do as a judge. Now, one interviewee was particularly dismissive of the idea that judging was, could be, or should be a neutral exercise, and that the individual judge was personally removed from the process of judging. So here's a little snippet of the conversation. So the box on the top, so LH is me. How much of a role do you think that social awareness or perhaps common sense plays in the work that you do as a judge? Judge, laughter. Laura, you can't just laugh. Judge, well, it's elemental. It's the start of everything else. It's possibly the first point and possibly the last post. Laura, okay, and in what ways? Some people have said that social awareness or common sense has nothing to do with the role of the judge, that it's just applying to the law and deciding cases. The judge, that is such nonsense, complete nonsense. So he gave pretty short shrift to the idea that judging was a purely neutral or objective exercise. Another judge, in the second quote you'll see below, emphasised that by rejecting the notion of neutrality and accepting the inevitable subjectivity that creeps into decision-making, as Madame Tolkien pointed out in her speech this morning, that courts can become closer to being impartial decision-making bodies. So this judge said, social awareness is intrinsic in the very nature of the judicial project. You can't simply rule by grammar, by technical analysis, by abstract reasoning. Judging isn't simply applying social awareness to problems. Social awareness feeds into it. It's one of the central elements of the judging process, but doesn't necessarily occupy the whole space. And so it's neither an add-on to a purely technical thing, nor is it the basic canvas. Okay. Sorry, interpreters. I think that's the wrong quote as well. Okay. That was the wrong slide. Sorry, everyone. Okay, so this quote actually, the second one, just ignore that for the moment. It's meant to be, I think social awareness is very important. It's the awareness of the other, which I think is so important to judicial impartiality, to really try and put oneself in the position of the other. None of us come to adjudication with a totally clean slate. I think the better the judge, the more aware he or she will be of the fact that we don't have a clean slate and so is prepared for counteracting preconceptions or preformed ideas. So when answering this question, most of my interviewees highlighted the delicate balance of adhering to the internal boundaries of legal decision making, whilst also ensuring that the decisions were situated and appropriate with reference to a broader social context. In this way, the interviewees, I feel, reflected Hill Collins' theory about the didactic relationship between formal legal rules and external subjective experiences. So the decision-making by judges is very much grounded in legal reasoning and legal rules. It's not purely subjective, but this is also means that it's not, it's far from being a mechanical process. And so this is actually what that second quote below that I read out to you before exemplifies. Okay. A judge from South Africa also highlighted the importance of context in determining the extent to which values and principles external to formal or written law would impact upon a judicial decision. This participant placed particular emphasis on decisions that are part of a transformative project. I think this was particularly acute in the awareness of the South African judges that I interviewed, given the rupture to their constitutional system some two decades ago, the ability of law and the importance of law to be a transformative tool is very much at the forefront of their mind. So this quote, to the extent that values occupy a central and often commanding place in the judicial function, social awareness becomes an imperative. In a case where the very nature of the constitutional project is transformatory, and without social awareness, transformation becomes rather meaningless, and then you are just juggling with abstract concepts and ideas. So, from this snapshot that I've tried to provide... So from this snapshot, we'll be able to see that assumptions that judging is a purely non-subjective exercise, I think for the large part, according to my interviewees, can be done away with. It's far from being unrestrained subjectivity, but what it is a continuous tension between rules and context. They all felt that social awareness and common sense played some role, and most of them felt it played an important role in judging. However, the question remains then, how does a judge become socially aware? How common is common sense? Interestingly, this was something that many of my female participants picked up on, and one opined in the second quote there, where you might think that X is common sense, and you find that a colleague has grown up in a different environment or a different life experience, it is not common sense. It might be an outright lie or certainly not be an accepted norm. So this leads to my next assumption that I presented at the beginning, that identity doesn't matter. And I'd like to start this with a quote from the former Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard upon her dramatic fall from office earlier this year. She was reflecting on gender and how it impacted upon her time in office. And she said, "It doesn't explain everything. It doesn't explain nothing. It does explain some things." And I think, unfortunately, for the lack of certainty, this is as close as I can come to a finding in my research to date. But I'd like to explain a little bit further what it can explain and what it can't explain, according to my interviewees. I think it's also important to think about what we mean by impact. What impact can gender have? And I'm going to consider it in two senses. First, people talk about impact on the outcome of a case, the way the judge decides. The second meaning of impact might be a little bit subtler. It concerns not the outcome, but rather what goes into the judgment, how the issues are considered by the judge, and how the gender might impact upon this, or how he or she interacts with the facts, the law, and his or her colleagues as they're making this decision and coming to a conclusion. So I think that we're all aware that there are a number of criticisms about outcomes-based research, and I believe that at best it's equivocal in what we can sort of learn from that. However, and I think my interviewees agreed with me to a certain extent about predicting outcomes. This quote here, the interviewee talked about the dangers of this, because you assume that you will decide on the basis of your gender, is dangerous to men and also to women. Yeah, it's problematic, and she believed that that's actually what scared the horses, so to speak, when we came to political advocacy for more gender equality. Another judge put it another way, and she was talking about identity determinism, and she called it the siren of identity determinism. So it was saying, and I'll read this quote in full, even though I see that my time is running low, that I think we need to be careful of assuming that although difference in identity, gender identity, or any other form of identity is a predictor of difference, our gender does not necessarily determine what our attitudes are, for instance. I really do believe that very fundamentally, so we have to be careful. I always call it the siren of identity determinism. We do not want gender diversity because women will represent women or women's views. We want it because because of the different life experiences that being a woman has probably means that you are likely to make a contribution to improving the impartiality and the open-mindedness of the bench. So she says, the siren of identity determinism suggests that you can never be different, and indeed you should never be different from other than from some preconception of what your gender or racial identity implies. And she said that that's what we must avoid. Now, I want to give some quick examples of the problems or the dangers of this identity determinism or essentialism. So with one of my interview participants, I asked him whether he thought that women's gender had an impact upon the way that they decided cases. And in particular, he drew me to a reference to cases involving sexual violence. Now, he considered that women were less lenient on the accused than their male colleagues, and I asked him, well, why do you think that is? Is it because they've practiced in that area previously? And he said, no, I don't think so. I think it's just human nature. The females, I suppose, are able to record the feeling and the trauma that the rape victim would have gone through, you know, better than we do as males. When I asked this participant whether or not he could think of an example where a man would naturally emphasize or naturally be better at an area of law than a woman, he said he was unable to give an example. I wonder how often, though, that this double standard puts increasing pressure on women judges to behave a particular way in certain cases, and how often this pressure is applied to men judges. So the second quote there, you can see that one of my participants was particularly alarmed by this kind of reasoning. She was very forthright in her rejection of this theory, that women judges were more empathetic to victims of sexual violence. And she spoke about the implications. She refers there in this quote to being vilified by lawyers' groups, particularly what she called women's groups, because she hadn't taken a particular stand on sentencing. She's been the butt of the criticism that women should feel more strongly that rapists should spend their entire lives in jail, and so on and so on. She also thought that family law was another area where she was presupposed, because of her gender, to arrive at a particular outcome. So in this way, I think that we have to be careful of identity determinism, because it can be seen to perpetuate stereotypes that have historically served to marginalise women in law. As was demonstrated by the interviewee who could not identify an area of law where men were naturally more equipped to judge, where women were naturally equipped to judge, but men weren't, this pressure is not often placed on men judges. Another danger occurs when we see that people see a responsibility on themselves to act in a certain way because of their gender. Or because of their identity, and where they see themselves as representing a particular group. And so here is an example in South Africa of a judge who felt that he was more in a better position than his white counterparts to understand customary South African law because of his colour. And so And if I can just have a grace of about 3 minutes just to get to the crux of it. Another interviewee considered these claims of authority that were derived from identity and experience posed a threat to impartiality. It's not that identity and experience were not valuable in forming judicial decisions, particularly in collegiate courts, but it was where a judge felt that they had authority as a result of their identity. That then served to cut them off from the discussion that happens in a collegiate court. It meant that their ears were closed to arguments. It meant that they found themselves with their own experience having a superior view. So one of my participants said that our gender or race doesn't determine views entirely, and we can remain capable of thinking for ourselves. And that means that men and women can have different views, and people of the same race can have different views, and a democracy based on human dignity like that is good. So I guess the difficulty is when people feel that they represent a group, they might be essentializing what the interests of that group actually is in thinking that they embody all of it. So just getting to the conclusion, I mean, if a judge background will not determine the outcome of its case, or it will not necessarily determine the weight that they place on various factors, well, what does it do? Does it have no desirable normative effect? And I'm not saying that at all. And I don't think that my participants were saying that at all. What they were saying was, and in relation to drawing back to my standpoint theory, a common response was that a bench with a diversity of genders experience can heighten the impartiality of the court by offering a broader base from where to consider what is normal or right. In this sense, diversity acts as a destabilizer in order to interrogate established truths, to see if they are, so to speak, common sense when compared to the various ways that we as women and men experience the world. It can be used in a collegiate context to interrogate personal subjectivity. It might also be used to bring to light contradictions or oddities in the law. Another experience as well, I just want to leave you with a final quote that gives an example of how this interrogation or this self-reflectiveness of one's own identity can enrich a judging process. So this comes from a South African judge, and she says, For instance, people who have not lived in rural areas don't know how hard it is just to have a bucket of water in your home. And if you come from that background and you sometimes go home and experience it firsthand, it's very difficult for you to explain to a person who does not have that advantage. The difficulty there are things that I know because sometimes when I am back in my house in the suburbs, I tend to take certain things for granted until I had go home where I grew up and realise how important it is to have a toilet that can flush. So this judge is not saying that because she had a particular experience, she necessarily has a superior claim or a superior understanding. It means that she has a different reference point. In this quotation as well, she refers to how she sometimes forgets that reference point, but needs to go back into her community to remember the experiences and to remember the richness of human experience that she has previously lived through. So in this way, I think that gendered experiential knowledge is a very important part of judging. And I think my final question that I would like to leave to the group, and maybe we can discuss it in the panel, is that how can we design courts and appointment processes so as to both identify and capitalise on broad bases of gendered experiential knowledge, but not to fall into the traps of essentialism or identity determinism that I've tried to show in my presentation today. So thank you.